This is New Books in Communications, and I'm Jeff Pooley. We're here today to talk to Michael Serrazio, who's author of Your Ad Here, The Cool Sell of Guerrilla Marketing, which is just out from NYU Press. Welcome to New Books in Communications, Michael, and thanks for making the time to talk to me today.
Thanks very much for the opportunity to be here.
So, let me just say a word about the book. It is truly superb. And if I can use a word that's at play in the book itself, it's, I think, authentically important. The book traces the mushrooming world of guerrilla marketing and here defined to include word of mouth, viral, advergaming, and really a host of other often hidden kinds of persuasion. And the book includes detailed case studies and also wonderful interviews with marketers. They're often hilarious and outrageous and rife with contradiction. And the book's lasting contribution, long after the marketers have moved on to colonize some other space that hasn't yet been bathed in commercialism, is to describe and critique the underlying logic at work. You trace, Michael, the ways in which guerrilla advertisers give up control, which is in a way handed over to consumers through quote unquote authentic discovery or conversation and dialogue or amateurism or even anti-marketing messages themselves, all of which serve paradoxically, you argue, to reinforce control, reinforce commercialism, reinforce a consumerist self. And the consumer subject, you write, is strategically engaged to act without the sense of being acted upon in any way. It's really brilliantly done, your exposure of what you call corporate ventriloquism. And I suppose I should state out front that this interview is not a stealth marketing ploy, that my enjoyment of the book is not astroturfed in any way. And so thanks again. I really enjoyed it. I think it deserves to be widely read and taught.
Well, thanks very much, Jeff. I really appreciate those kind words. It was a really enjoyable project to tackle.
Great. So, I mean, maybe you could say a little bit about your background. I mean, what brought you into the field of media studies?
Sure, absolutely. So I come to the world of media studies from having been, a former practitioner of it, in a sense. I had been a professional journalist before going back to grad school for my PhD. I had done my first master's degree at Columbia Journalism School, and then had worked for a couple of years as a reporter for an alt-weekly down in Houston, Texas, which was, fantastic and, eye-opening and invigorating and kind of all the great things that journalism can offer someone. I realized as a reporter that my favorite part when I was doing a story was when I got to call up a professor somewhere to sort of add some context and meaning to the facts on the ground that I was reporting on. It's called the cosmic graph in journalism when you come to that part in the story where the reporter gets to tell you what it all means. And I really enjoyed that part of the reporting so much and stories that were ultimately about ideas. So with that, as kind of my driving passion and also a limited sense of nervousness about the precarious state of American journalism, this would have been back in 2005, I decided to go back to grad school for a PhD and to try and pursue, a career as a professor. I knew very much that my academic research, teaching, writing interests sort of sit at the nexus of media and culture, and so that became the focal point for a lot of my graduate studies. Some of the various published journal articles that I've done prior to the release of this book.
Great. And, this book in itself, if I'm not mistaken, didn't it grow out of a dissertation?
Yeah, it did. And in a much earlier version of it. Yeah. I knew, as far as the genesis of the idea for this book, I knew I wanted to do something about cultural production. As my kind of media studies training sensitized me, I realized increasingly in that kind of three-part process of studying the media, where you can sort of look at production, the texts themselves, the content itself, and then kind of the reception or effects side. I realized, you know, the more my studies went on, the more interested I was in really the kind of production or encoding part of that process, to borrow Stuart Hall's term. And so I knew that was going to be the context of a big project. I didn't know initially that it would be advertising. I thought it could have been, you know, cultural production as it relates to journalism, possibly, you know, television. But ultimately, what I realized as I kind of thought through the different possibilities was that, you know, as advertising goes, so goes the fate of so many of our favorite, you know, pop culture and media forms and texts. And so, and seeing the profound changes that were happening between, you know, changes in technology, changes in, you know, delivery of content, things like that, seeing how advertising is, reflecting and reacting to a lot of those changes became a way to study cultural production in a lot of other sectors. So, parts of the book do look at how, you know, advertising and journalism commingle in this new environment. Parts of the book look at how, you know, advertising and, you know, film or pop, you know, pop music intermingle. Parts of it look at, you know, how advertising and sort of social networks and new media intermingle. And so, you know, advertising really wound up becoming the sort of the way in which I was able to look at a lot of these other facets of cultural production through a really interesting historical moment where technology is changing and the industry is trying to catch up to that. So that was sort of, I guess, the kind of genesis of the book's idea.
And I imagine that the dissertation doesn't resemble too closely the book that NYU Press just published. And maybe you could just say something about that perhaps painful or maybe pleasurable process of transforming your dissertation.
Yeah, I mean, if only it was, it was that easy to just send off the disc. No, it was, and the reviewers, the anonymous reviewers who wound up, you know, working on the manuscript and reviewing it, provided just incredibly thorough, helpful feedback, particularly helping me refine the kind of theoretical front end of the book. They provided great insight in terms of, how to make some of my uses of Foucault work better, some of my uses of Gramsci. And I think that they added an incredible array of really helpful questions to try and, you know, tease out exactly what it was I wanted to say about a lot of these trends and patterns that, you know, I think I come at them with, certainly hopefully a healthy degree of skepticism. But at the same time, you know, something of, you know, ambivalence. I think, you know, readers will hopefully not see this necessarily as a kind of Jeremiad or screed, hopefully a kind of measured critique of this new advertising phenomenon. So the feedback that I was able to get in those formative stages of the manuscript was just really incredibly helpful to help really convert it a long way from where it had been when I left grad school.
Well, great. Even the title itself kind of invites some definitional work. I mean, I wonder if you might describe to listeners what the phrase cool sell means in
sure.
this context, and also guerrilla marketing itself, which sure. Which you define broadly. So yeah. Why don't you give us that?
Absolutely. Those two terms kind of act as really key theoretical vehicles for a lot of the book. I'll start with the second one, guerrilla marketing. Guerrilla marketing is really my central core argument of the book. And that's, you know, if I could sort of summarize it succinctly, I would say that increasingly a lot of the new advertising experiments, innovations, and tactics we're seeing resemble metaphorically a kind of guerrilla warfare strategy for reaching consumers. So if we think of conventional warfare, right, it was all about, the history of warfare is really about, you know, the kind of the history of an evolution of warfare. And historically, centuries ago, it was about armies lining up with very clear uniforms on very clear battlefields. Everything was sort of circumscribed, well-defined, contained. And, you know, the two armies would skirmish it out. To me, I see that same metaphor lending itself to a lot of the history of traditional advertising, right? Your commercials lined up in very clear spots, at, you know, 30 spots, the commercial break on TV, the advertising content in newspapers or magazines was very clearly separated from the editorial content. Banners on a web page would kind of run to the side of all this, right? And so if that's the kind of conventional warfare equivalent for trying to reach audiences and consumers' attention spans, what I see happening when we look at the increase in product placement, the rise of buzz marketing, some of the social media strategies, and some of the kind of alt culture kind of outdoor strategies is really the guerrilla warfare innovation. It's about putting content, putting advertising content in non-traditional spaces so that it doesn't look like advertising. Why does it not want to look like advertising? Because we don't want to look at advertising as consumers and audiences. We avoid it. We skip it. We zap it. We TiVo it out. And so I think that logic is definitely not lost on advertisers themselves. And so there's a fundamental, I find, and especially as I went through and did a lot of these interviews, a fundamental self-effacement about the project of advertising when you talk to marketers. They don't want their content to look like advertising because audiences will ignore it. So that becomes the kind of, you know, central abiding metaphor. And as I wound up reading Che Guevara's textbook for, guerrilla warfare, it was just interesting how many parallels there were between warfare and marketing. And you hear that in the ad world as well. I mean, that comes down to you can even boil it down to the fundamental unit of both sales and war, which is the campaign. So actually, when you wind up looking at sort of advertising speak, there's already a lot of militarized metaphors being, you know, bounced around. But when I looked at Che Guevara's sort of theories of warfare, it wound up sounding a lot like what I was hearing in these new ad strategies. So that's part of the title. The other part of the title, The Cool Sell, is a somewhat coy, playful adoption of Marshall McLuhan's terms, hot and cold media. These would have come out of his book from back in the 60s, Understanding Media. So if we think of hot media are basically high definition, very very low engagement expected out of audiences. Cool media are a little bit lower in resolution and higher in audience participation. I kind of appropriate those terms to talk about the hot sell being this kind of traditional over the top sort of Times Square advertisements being blared in your face, Billy Mays forcing the infomercial down your throat, very kind of obvious, overt strategy of reaching consumers where, there's not much the consumer is interpolated or addressed to do other than just, just acquiesce and sort of be passive. The hot sell addressed consumers in a way that expected them to be a little bit more passive. The cool sell, by contrast, I argue, anticipates some interactivity, some freedom on the part of the consumer, something whereby they figure it out for themselves in ways small and large. And so I found McLuhan's hot and cold media a useful way of really looking at this, because when you look at the ad industry, there's a big shift happening from impressions being the crucible by which you determine whether a campaign is effective. That would, been the kind of traditional way you define whether you're getting the message across, to nowadays, engagement is just the buzzword du jour. And, that speaks to an ad industry that is thinking about and addressing the consumer in a very different sort of more actively, inciting way. So, those are the kind of two terms that sort of weave themselves throughout the book and the different case studies that I look at.
Well, that's perfect. And, it segues really well into a question I have about what I think is perhaps the book's main theme, and the way that the cool sell, ironically, because of its disinterested, hands-off, even dissident attitude that you just described, you say is a kind of power or governance. You're drawing, as you already mentioned, on Antonio Gramsci and Michel Foucault to make this paradoxical argument that the guerrilla marketer's embrace of agency for the consumer, dissent, and flexibility works to keep that kind of quote unquote empowered consumer governed.
Yeah.
Power through freedom, as you put it at some point in the book. And can you explain what you mean by this strange seeming idea?
Yeah, it is paradoxical for sure. Because it's paradoxical also as it plays out in the discourse and practices of advertisers themselves. This is a group, advertisers whose fundamental task at the end of the day is to control the consumer, is to deliver the consumer to clients and in a state of mind that makes them receptive to purchasing their products. So the idea that advertisers would be embracing this sort of notion of freedom and producing disinterested content is very ironic, because this goes against fundamentally what they get paid for. The advertisers don't get paid at the end of the day for creating freedom on behalf of consumers. No, they ultimately need to create some sort of cultural funnel that will, angle them toward, buying products and selling widgets or whatever. Particularly, I found Foucault extremely useful, and I will, for sure caveat this by saying that I'm by no means an expert on all of Foucault's work, and it can be certainly and was for me a challenge to think through and work through. But I found some of his later writings on governmentality a really effective way of thinking about how you could sort of shepherd a subject toward desired ends. For most of, as I understand it, how Foucault has been used and applied and advanced over the years is it tends to be more of the kind of the self administering to the self, the self governing the self. But I found, that the same sort of language that he uses to describe this exercise of power, where you're trying to create this field of possibilities that will structure the possible field of action of the subject, was a really effective way of thinking about what these new advertisers are trying to do, thanks to the tools, the technological advances that they've been afforded, and some of the new cultural fronts that they're opening up to be able to speak to consumers. And so that just became a way of looking at and thinking about this power through freedom theme and some of the other themes that kind of weave themselves throughout the book. The idea that we don't like as audiences or as consumers and audiences to feel like something has been chosen for us. We want to feel like the decision was ours, and that's what advertisers are very much trying to play to. They don't want to overstep on our sense of agency. And so there's a very sort of delicate dance that plays out that's paradoxical and contradictory, but truly fascinating to see how, advertisers try to address consumers in this way. And particularly, I should add, youth consumers. A lot of the book is about strategies for campaigns that are chasing after teens and young adults. And there's, different interesting reasons and theories for why this particular demographic, this particular psychographic responds especially well or especially poorly to, the hot sell and perhaps responds more effectively to this cool sell idea. But it really, it really is kind of, it is about sort of power through freedom and sort of, if you're shifting from impressions, an impression is simply, a kind of a passive audience, just, some things being impressed upon them. Engagement suggests that they're, leaning forward and engaging with it in a way that embraces their sense of freedom. So it's it's just a theme that wound up, kind of weaving throughout the book.
Yeah. One of the best things about the book is the many, many interviews you did with marketers of different kinds, and the way that they would engage in really quite revealing sort of verbal gymnastics, sort of trying to thread the difference between the empowering language on the one hand and also the fact that they are in the business of delivering consumers to purchase yeah. products, and that fundamental fact, and ultimately they're in the persuasion business. So
yeah.
It's really quite wonderful to read them square that circle. So, you know, getting into the body of the book, you talk about something related to what you just discussed, which is ambient governance, which is a wonderful phrase. And you're developing that idea in the body of the book in a chapter looking at product placement and also things like advergaming. And maybe you could spell out what you mean by ambient governance with an example that you discussed. And I think some listeners will know of, at least, America's Army.
Sure, absolutely. So I will preface this by saying that, you know, a lot of folks in the ad industry would not use guerrilla marketing to encompass all of the different case studies that I look at. I mean, if a marketer picked up this book, and I hope that one or two do, and read it, they would be surprised that I was including, you know, something like product placements under the umbrella of guerrilla marketing. But to me, it fits really well with, to go back to that theme of advertising creeping into spaces that it has not historically occupied. You know, that being said, I do in that second chapter try to illuminate how there is a precedence for branded content showing up, and there is a precedence for product placements. Now, the explosion of it over the past decade suggests that something is new here. I mean, it's not just what they've always been doing. But soap operas are named that way because they were initially, you know, financed by detergent companies back in the heyday of, you know, radio and television. So ambient governance, really kind of tries to get at, the central tension as, it plays itself out in product placement and branded content. And that is, how do you create pop culture that sells products that doesn't seem like it's trying to sell products? And that speaks to this challenge, this conundrum that advertisers have in trying to work through these third-party intermediaries, right? Whether it be, the director and writers on a James Bond film or a TV show, whether it be pop music artists who we're seeing are increasingly embedding in their lyrics and their music videos, sponsored content, whether we're seeing more and more in really fascinating ways that ambient governance being embedded in journalistic content. It's been very fascinating to study, especially in the past year or two, the rise of a lot of this sponsored content in really not just upstarts like the Huffington Post and BuzzFeed, but places like The Atlantic and The Washington Post that are really informs that are really starting to rely upon branded content in a very kind of guerrilla marketing type way. Mm. The particular example that I find especially illuminating is America's Army. It's a very interesting case study. So the U.S. military had a lot of difficulty, it revealed to me in the interview, had talked about, having a lot of difficulty really speaking to the millennial youth. They parroted a lot of the my interviewee parroted the typical line that high school kids, you can't get to them through the 30-second TV commercial. How do we reach these kids? How do we speak to them in a way that seems authentic? And so what they did was they developed this video game that was a free download. It's called America's Army. It's basically like a first-person shooter game, and really it's a very emblematic shift because to me, the classic Army marketing strategy is Uncle Sam with his, finger pointed at the viewer of a poster or an advertisement, saying, "I want you." And that's a very sort of hard sell kind of archetype. But this America's Army game, it's never really trying to sell you anything. And that was what emerged in my interviews with the colonel who developed this game. They're not trying to sell you on the Army. They're not trying to sort of force the Army down your throat if you're a gamer. Hopefully you just, get into the game, you learn the protocols, you learn the values, and it winds up sort of cultivating that brand identity in your mind. And he really, it sort of frames really nicely the advergaming strategy, which is very much about interactivity, about casual, subtle, sort of message. I mean, the message "join the Army" is at once everywhere and nowhere in a video game like America's Army, and so it's a really kind of classic example of it sort of exists in the ambience of the game itself. So that's sort of where that ambient governance idea came from.
Yeah, that's great. And one of the pleasures of reading the book was exposure to new terms like Avergaming, I suppose is not that new. Mm-hmm. But you also talk about guerrilla marketing in the purest sense, I suppose, in a chapter that touches on what the industry apparently sometimes calls alt-outdoors. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the idea here is to use sometimes graffiti or brandalism, as it mm-hmm. can be called, or mm-hmm. Radical political tropes, or at least the form of those tropes, and the antics of culture jamming activists like the Adbusters guys and others, like the Yes Men. So you know, it's a fascinating chapter that talks about how resistance, in this case, kind of openly anti-marketing resistance, finds its way back into the Naomi Klein quoting marketer's quiver. So perhaps you could talk about this. You know, you use the example of PBR or some other example.
Yeah. This was a really interesting chapter to work on. This and that particular chapter that sort of looks at these alt culture sort of strategies of graffiti or branded flash mobs. I mean, that really is what the industry considers, in a very limited sense, guerrilla marketing. So if you were to ask an advertiser about guerrilla marketing, it would really be those types of strategies that they would assume that you were talking about. And it was interesting to trace all of the parallels that showed up between a lot of the both theories and practices of culture jammers, throughout the, you know, 90s and thereafter, and see how those mapped onto some of the strategies of guerrilla marketing in this sense. As you mentioned, I think the PBR example is a really interesting one, because PBR had managed to cultivate about 10 years ago, PBR wound up just gaining this sort of hipster cachet. And it really came as something of a surprise to the company, as I understand it. And so they brought in some brand consultants to sort of figure out, like, okay, we thought we were marketing to this kind of blue collar old man demographic, but turns out we're doing really well in Portland and Williamsburg and with sort of punk subcultures, with sort of bicycle messenger subcultures. And how did this, how did this happen, but really how do we wind up cultivating that momentum? And what was really interesting to hear and read about what the brand consultants did on this is they really tried to avoid marketing PBR to this demographic that was embracing it. The consultant on it said that he was trying to allow these subcultures to choose PBR rather than having the brand chosen for them. So, for example, if PBR was going to sponsor a bike messenger race, they wouldn't hang banners all over the place, blaring PBR, in 64-point font. They would try and keep it very casual. They would even serve, as I understand it, competing beer brands, right? And so, again, this kind of betrays a new way of addressing a very jaded, cynical consumer for something like PBR. And it really speaks to this kind of, resistance alt culture strategy. Another great example that came out of this was one of the most sort of famous public service campaigns of the past 10 or 15 years, and that would be the Truth Anti-Smoking campaign, which here again targeted a very sort of cynical, at-risk teen target for its messages to try and get them to not smoke or to stop smoking. And they took a very explicit kind of culture jamming approach to it, where they were trying to prank the ad industry as a way of getting teens to realize that the ad industry was tricking them into thinking that smoking is cool, and the ad agency Crispin Porter Burgoski down in Miami that sort of handled this it was without a doubt probably the one of the biggest and maybe the top agency of the last 10 years as far as these innovations go. And so this chapter was kind of all about looking at how you try to cultivate cool in this new cultural landscape. What you draw upon, what different aesthetics and practices you draw upon, whether it be graffiti and stickers like something, Banksy or Shepherd Fairey might create, or, branded flash mobs more recently than that. And really here again, all of these examples are sort of very guerrilla in nature, right? They're not, they avoid seeming like advertising at all costs, because the assumption is that consumers can't be convinced by something that looks like traditional advertising, particularly the consumers that they're chasing after here, hipsters and teens who might smoke. So yeah, this was a, you know, this was sort of a chapter that highlighted all of those different strategies.
And, you know, the same point gets made in the next couple of chapters, but without perhaps the sort of hip resistant edge with word of mouth marketing and, mm-hmm. and peer-to-peer marketing or buzz mm-hmm. marketing. You even call it, I think, borrowing from an industry rep, a real life product placement.
Yeah, it's a great phrase.
It is. It seemed like you even signed up to serve as a kind of AstroTurf shill in the name of research for one of these firms.
I did. And they never sent me any fun stuff. I was totally hoping to score some swag from them. And I think I just didn't. I didn't meet their demographic desires on whatever campaigns they were running. Yeah. No, it's I mean, it's really interesting because, you know, when you talk to advertisers, the conventional wisdom, and I think it's, you know, been proven out by research, is that by far the best advertisement is a friend's recommendation. I mean, by far and away, the sort of most convincing way that you can get people to buy your stuff is to have their friends say that it's great. This is something that has both been around for a long time and has also increased tremendously in recent years. It was fascinating to go back and look at some of the history of early PR, looking at some of the work of Edward Bernays, who's just a really fascinating figure, the kind of father of public relations, and some of the techniques that he used 60 years ago, 70 years ago, where, you know, he worked on behalf of the bacon brand, and in order to get, get more bacon sold, he wound up convincing a bunch of physicians to sort of recommend it to their patients. And you can trace that through, you know, in various forms and instantiations throughout the 20th century. But really, buzz marketing took off really in this past 10 years or so. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is structural. It's a lot easier to run word-of-mouth campaigns where you're sending out samples of stuff and you're getting back feedback on how these products are being talked up with friends once you have a system like the internet to kind of facilitate that communication very easily. And also, you know, we're living through a populist turn in terms of who creates the media that we consume. And increasingly, you know, we're consuming a lot more of our sort of friends' social media. And so that became a reason for marketers to investigate more and more. How do I stimulate what has otherwise been spontaneous for decades with regards to word of mouth recommendations? How do I organize something that had been otherwise organic? And so you have companies like BuzzAgent, which has, you know, 500,000 buzz agents and sort of volunteers that, that get free products, talk them up with friends, and then, you know, report back to the company on that dialogue. One of my other interviews, as you mentioned, conducts similar type of thing that he called real life product placement, which is, you know, just one of those, when you're doing an interview and you hear something like that come up, it's just like, it's great, you know.
As a former journalist, especially.
Absolutely. So, that's another thing where it's about trying to sort of insinuate and, you know, even script, although there'll be some disagreements on, you know, how much it's scripted, some of these products into everyday life with folks. This has been a source of growth, and this, raises a lot of interesting questions about the authenticity of our interactions with friends, and that's what makes them that, you know, that's what makes that space so fertile to marketers. I mean, authenticity is the central preoccupation, in my opinion, of marketers nowadays, because their fundamental task is the opposite of it. I mean, their fundamental task mm-hmm. is contrivance. And so that's why they're obsessed with authenticity. And, you know, I don't blame them, because that's, you know, sort of what they need to do in order to achieve that kind of systemic goal. But it's something that we're, you know, seeing more and more of, showing up in terms of, growth and ad spending toward those projects in the industry.
Right. So you know, you kind of hit on the topic of the importance of not seeming inauthentic, of kind of coming across as spontaneous, even if there's a calculation underneath. And I think you get at this really well when you talk in this chapter about the what you call the dilemma of disclosure, because there's apparently a word of mouth marketing association or something close to that has made it a kind of ethical mandate to disclose word of mouth campaigns about working for a client. And yet, you know, I mean, maybe you could speak to the fact that were this ethical guideline followed religiously, what would the impact be on the entire campaign itself?
Yeah. It's a really interesting question because as you say, this Word of Mouth Marketing Association was founded maybe 5 or 10 years ago now in response to a lot of the industry growth in this area. And it lays out this very sort of ethical standard, and a lot of the major companies that operate in this space do proclaim very loudly and repeatedly that they follow it, that disclosure needs to take place. So if you get, you know, I don't know, some free phone or something from a company and you are trying it out and talking it up with friends, they expect you to say, you know, this is, a product that was brought to me by, you know, Buzz Agent or whatever company brought it, you know, and that's why I got it and this is what I'm doing. I believe, and you examine their, you know, the various Buzz companies materials, and they make it very clear to agents. And I believe that they, you know, that they, you know, they are sort of officially saying that this is what we want to do. But it just strikes me as odd, because part of why word of mouth marketing is touted as so effective is because it doesn't look like marketing. Right. So if you're having this sort of, this sort of stilted caveat that you'd expect your buzz agents to introduce into their conversations with friends, I mean, it just creates, first of all, awkwardness. I just think myself, if I had gotten, you know, some free swag, you know, when I was working on behalf, you know, when I signed up for a buzz agent, you know, would I have felt compelled to, you know, to introduce that disclosure into my conversations, or would I just let it slide? I don't know. If I'm being honest, I'd probably just let it slide. And I wonder how many people, you know, share the same feeling. And I wonder if in its heart of hearts, these buzz agent companies, you know, really, really do want that disclosure to take place, because what they sell as an effective competitor to traditional advertising is the fact that it doesn't, you know, look like traditional advertising. And, I know that there's, you know, legal things here and, you know, factors like that, but it's just a very curious conundrum, because it would seem to denaturalize something that's otherwise very natural, which is just, you know, chatting with friends and whatnot. And, you know, there again is the fundamental task of advertising, which is, you know, contrivance. And how do you work that contrivance into our everyday lives, whether it be, you know, pop culture or the conversations with friends? It becomes a challenging thing to suss out.
Okay, great. Yeah, I mean, I think that's really clear in the book. And, you know, as with the rest of the book, you're aiming to, I mean, show basically how certain kinds of half real agency are harnessed to sell stuff, right? And sort of to bypass the man in order to stuff his pockets, basically. Mm. You know? Mm. And you know, one of the things I really like about these two chapters is that you're puzzling over the fact that so many of us are willing to volunteer for free, basically, as brand ambassadors and buzz agents. And yet, you know, you avoid the simplistic notion that we're all kind of duped, all of us who are signing up for buzz agent and so on. And instead, you know, you refer to a wider culture of what you're calling social capitalism that makes buzz agentry almost a natural step for a populace that's already self-branding on Facebook and elsewhere.
Yeah.
I just thought, you know, if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was the central sort of question that I puzzled over as I was sort of working through this material is the fact that, you know, the people who are participating in this, you know, they might be shills, but they're not dupes, you know? And so, and they're not required by any means. I mean, they're not getting paid for this, but they're, you know, they're maybe getting free samples. So why do we, you know, why would we participate in this? Why do buzz agents go in for this? And it's not, you know, this book is very clearly, as I said from the start, an encoding study, not a decoding study. I'm not looking at sort of audiences reception and, you know, buzz agents themselves, why they do this. But to me, it speaks to the fact that these companies can initiate these sort of practices would seem to suggest that we're already comfortable with defining ourselves through consumer goods. And because consumerism plays such a large part in our lives, that maybe part of it is, you know, part of the appeal for people who take part in this is being kind of in the know on, you know, new products and new fads and new trends as they come out. And that's partly what these buzz agent companies sell to their volunteers, is that you will be in the know and that you will have, you know, you will be able to drive a kind of social capital, and you're being asked to participate because they assume you have social capital because you have, you know, 1,000 friends on Facebook who, you know, like and comment on your statuses regularly. And so, you know, all of that sort of contributes, you know, to this notion of, you know, and you've written about this, and a lot of, you know, very smart people have written about this, is, you know, the self as a brand, right? And so, you know, once you kind of consider yourself more and more along those lines, and once it doesn't become a problem to sort of define yourself in those ways, then, you know, then working and aligning yourself with, you know, brands in the social space is not that strange. And you know, I mean, even people who don't, you know, necessarily sign up to be buzz agents probably recognize, I think, to some degree, this social capitalism that weaves its way into our lives and our interactions in these spaces. And so, you know, it speaks to some of that ambivalence that I have about a lot of this stuff, which is to say that, you know, these are not mindless sort of dupes in a kind of, you know, Frankfurt School sense, who are taking part in this, you know, who are complicit in some, you know, nefarious culture industries, you know, machinations. This is, you know, everyday folks who, you know, maybe just think they're going to be the first one on their block to know about a new product. And that is probably understandably appealing in modern life.
Okay, good. And, you know, that does really segue well into that next chapter where you're talking about strategies that involve, you know, participation, basically, from the consumer. And I guess you'd say viral social media campaigns would fall into this. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, you talk about in this chapter crowdsourced advertising like Doritos has done, and other, you know, tactics in which the consumer is basically enlisted as the laborer in at least spreading, but sometimes even generating the material. And as you talk about, you know, the consumer's amateur authenticity is what's key, right? So I thought maybe you could talk about either this great Burger King subservient chicken example or or Ford Fiesta or something else terms of talking about free labor, which is sort of packaged as democratic participation.
Absolutely, yeah. So partly what this fifth chapter in the book is about is about these kind of different crowdsourced or consumer-generated marketing examples. And these really hinge, as you say, on the credibility of the amateur. I mean, the amateur, you know, over the past 10 or 15 years, I guess 10 years or so of sort of Web 2.0 networked life, the amateur has been, you know, venerated throughout in a lot of, you know, powerful ways. I mean, it's the amateur who populates our Facebook, you know, status, you know, our news feeds every day. It's the amateur who populates the, you know, incredible amount of content that's put on YouTube. I mean, the amateur really holds a very laurel place in modern, you know, pop culture, media culture life. And so this is precise. I mean, the fact that the amateur has credibility in contrast to the professional, which is a really interesting distinction there that I sort of try to play with. The fact that the amateur has credibility is of course, exactly where the advertiser wants to go. The fact that the amateur is authentic is, of course, exactly where the advertiser wants to go. And things that go viral have that same sort of sheen of authenticity, right? That, mm-hmm. And anytime something goes viral, it has a kind of populist ethos about it. It's a kind of, something goes viral, it's not because it was put on, you know, 1,000 screens nationwide, you know, on a particular Friday. It's, you know, something goes viral, it's not because an advertiser paid, you know, millions of dollars to have it, you know, bombarded on a Super Bowl ad. If something goes viral, it sort of rises up from the people. There's a very kind of populist, democratic ethos informing this. And so something like the Ford Fiesta campaign that Ford ran, I think, is really instructive in this example. They had a new, you know, subcompact car that they were hoping to roll out. And rather than do a very sort of traditional mass media buy marketing strategy, what they did instead is they wound up having a contest. And, you know, again, so many sort of amateur media things are all about contests. They had a contest where they invited participants to sort of prove themselves to be social media butterflies, right? So you applied, and if you had enough followers,
on, you know, this was a couple of years ago, so enough followers on MySpace and YouTube and whatnot, enough, you know, Twitter followers, then you were granted, you know, one of, I think, 100, you know, Ford Fiesta sort of buzz agents. And basically they got a free car for a year. They got, you know, free gas, insurance, whatnot. And all they had to do was post content once a month around different themes, you know, adventure, sort of social, you know, activism, stuff like that. And this really was, you know, a way of Ford kind of, you know, riding on the credibility of these amateurs and these, you know, social media butterflies, and really trying to, you know, really trying to work through, you know, their brand strategy in kind of these through these authentic intermediaries and their Web 2.0 productivity. And so that was, you know, this was another example of Ford trying to reach millennials. You know, as I say, a lot of the examples from the book are really sort of oriented toward younger audiences and younger consumer demographics. And so this, you know, became one example from the chapter. Another example that you mentioned is the is what is considered probably the first viral, you know, sensation of advertising, you know, of the 21st century. And that would be the Burger King subservient chicken. About 7 years ago, Burger King, working with Crispin Porter Burgoski, sort of famous ad agency from the past decade, created this very strange website where you when you clicked on it or you went to it, all it had was a chicken in a room, like a kind of a dingy looking sort of living room, and it had a little field that you could enter in commands for the chicken to do. You know, one of a host of 300 or 400 different commands, the chicken would perform those actions. And this was part of, you know, Burger King's strategy to sell to, I think as my interviewee told me, to sort of sell to like stone teens, basically, who just get on the internet and want to look for like wacky stuff. You know, this became a huge viral success. I mean, the numbers are in the book as far as you know how many times this URL was forwarded and how much of an impact it made in terms of website visitors, stuff like that. And you know, it's really interesting because there's nothing about that website that directly, explicitly, obliquely connects to Burger King. And it's just sort of a way of sort of building a viral buzz about it. And you know, people have debated about whether or not it actually sold, you know, chicken sandwiches or not. That's kind of another separate question. But it very much was about trying to work itself into an online ad space that didn't appear to be pushing a cheeseburger onto you.
Right, which is in a way encapsulates the whole point of what you're calling guerrilla marketing here. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, since we're running out of time, I'm curious about whether you think there are implications for, you know, the field itself. I mean, there's this long tradition going back at least to personal influence in 1955 mm-hmm. through some audience studies in the 80s and 90s and on through Henry Jenkins and others today that plays up audience agency and freedom vis-a-vis the media. And, you know, you're talking about and quoting marketers making some of these same claims, but your story overall complicates it. And so I'm just wondering how you might articulate that.
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's actually one that at this point, I don't think I actually have a sort of, you know, definitive statement about because you're correct. I mean, there have been, a long history in media studies of fantastic, you know, studies of how creative consumers and audiences can be, you know, just how, you know, sort of active they can be in the process of making meaning out of media texts. And you know, what this book, I think, tries to do is by no means to invalidate any of those claims or findings, but rather to simply look at how, you know, the culture industries are trying to work with a lot of those same trends and think through a lot of those same patterns. Because, you know, it struck me as I was sort of doing the kind of background research on this topic and sort of seeing that, you know, not a lot had been, you know, sort of done yet looking at these phenomenon, is that, you know, there's a lot to be, you know, learned and explored with regard to cultural producers and how they think about audiences and how they think about the agency of audiences and trying to program to that agency.
And I know that part of the reason why, you know, a lot of this doesn't get done is because it's a challenge of access. But I think that what we see happening, at least in the advertising world, and I think it'll spill over, you know, it has spilled over into other media culture industries, is that they are catering to those, to those consumer trends and audience patterns. And the more we can kind of keep an eye on how the advertising industry is dealing with that, the better we can understand this sort of very complex portrait of where the audience and the consumer sits in sort of modern day media culture. Because as I say, this is, you know, even though I spend all my time with the tricksters in this book, with the, you know, the persuaders, I'm by no means arguing that, you know, audiences are being, you know, sort of duped in a superficial sense. Rather, I think what I'm trying to argue is that because the process of persuasion has become so complex and complicated and requiring nuance nowadays, that very much the audience as active, sophisticated, creative is a truth. And that's mm-hmm. partly what cues a lot of these, similarly sophisticated, clever, you know, underhanded, if you know, you want to call it that, or perhaps just, sly, marketing strategies.
Right. I mean, that really does come through as a thread throughout the entire book, just that the agency that advertisers and marketers are playing to is, frankly, as they admit, maybe even overemphasize, is real. And they are kind of hitching themselves to that agency in subtle ways. So good. I mean, is there anything that we didn't have a chance to talk about that you think is particularly important? I mean, it's such a rich book and we really had to gloss through it fast. But is there anything that you wanted to highlight?
No, I mean, I thank you again for the really kind words and opportunity to talk on this series. I think one thing, and it's a sort of very small note in the book, and I mentioned it a little bit earlier, is going forward, it will be really interesting to see how this winds up impacting journalism. And I look at all this as someone who still, in some ways, fundamentally identifies as a journalist as much as a scholar, and looks with great trepidation on what's happened to the journal, you know, to the world of news over the past 5 or 7 years, and the degree to which guerrilla marketing will seep into and influence journalism in different ways. The notion of a separation of church and state between editorial and advertising was, of course, you know, a historical artifact that didn't always exist, but it may well turn out to, you know, I mean, we may see that that you know, supposedly ironclad separation, you know, becoming increasingly porous, and it'll be really interesting to kind of track how this winds up, you know, playing out in that realm as well.
Yeah, and that ironclad separation of a different kind between public relations and, on the one hand, and advertising and marketing on the other, is also, for very similar reasons, under assault, as you talk about in the book quite a lot. And yeah. I mean, the practice of influencing journalism has usually been the province of PR, but you come away from reading your book with the conclusion that there isn't anything fundamental anymore, if there ever was, that separates public relations from at least this kind of guerrilla marketing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something we're seeing with sort of mergers, you know, in the ad industry, and also, you know, the more kind of social media and you know, social media strategy becomes a central part of what brands are trying to do, the more they're leaning on PR firms and PR agencies, you know, within their various, you know, marketing holdings conglomerates to be able to reach out in those capacities. So it's a really interesting thing to follow.
Yeah, and it really is almost like the, you know, you hearken back to Ebert Bernays, but his sort of fundamental innovation, if that's the right word, that, you know, third-party credibility is the key to getting a message successfully delivered and accepted. And, you know, in some ways, lots of these different techniques, aren't they? They're kind of drawing on third-party credibility, whether that be sort of hipster authenticity or the amateur or what have you. So, well, I'm curious, you know, you mentioned this issue around journalism. Are you working on a journalism slash guerrilla marketing project next?
What
is it? Yeah.
Yeah, in a manner of speaking, I had the good fortune just this past fall to have a research leave from teaching, and I wound up pursuing a new project that tracks pretty closely to some of the same themes and questions that I look at in the book. But instead of locating it in sort of brands and consumer culture, I look at it in the world of political marketing and political campaigns. So, you know, whereas the book is sort of based upon, you know, these, 45 or 50 interviews that I did with brand managers and creative directors who are using these strategies and dealing with these technologies to sell us goods. I've just done about 40 or so interviews with campaign managers and political advertising creatives and political digital strategy specialists, folks of that, you know, press secretaries, folks of that sort. Again, asking a lot of these sort of same questions about how does technology change what you do? How are you thinking about, how are you thinking about things like branding in the context of politics? And it was a really sort of fruitful research period. I've got a whole stack of interviews that I'm sort of working through and trying to sort of identify some of the main themes. Basically the kind of next project tries to sort of build on this momentum, but locating it sort of more in the world of politics. And it was, you know, a good moment in the fall with the election to be able to sort of chart some of these threads as they showed up in various campaigns that we saw.
Well, it sounds really interesting. And, you know, I imagine you had some experiences of deja vu listening to the political operatives talk about the audience and so on. I mean, it must have eerily mimicked some of the cultural marketers that you talked to in
this
book. Yeah.
It did. Yeah.
Well, great. I mean, best of luck with that. And thank you again for taking the time to talk to me. And congratulations on what is a truly superb book.
Oh, thanks very much, Jeff. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it today. And I appreciate all the kind words.
You've been listening to New Books in Communications. Thanks so much for joining us. And we'll see you next time.